Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Well, the trial and inquiry and to find out what happened to the Russian opposition leader, Boris Nemtsov, is actually going to be underway. But we actually need to take a look at how Vladimir Putin uses the media to project his views within the country and to the outside world. A lot of people are saying this is nothing more than a show trial. Well, we'll actually have to wait and see to see if that is actually the outcome. Ben Judah is the author of a book called Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. He speaks next to Richard Ady.
Russian elite have in many ways rejected the idea of truth, and you very frequently hear from leading Russian politicians, and I've heard personally from the head of Russia Today, who told me that they don't believe in this idea of truth. They believe there are only narratives, and that they will control the narratives, and they will spread narratives, and they reject the idea that there's any such thing as objectivity, and there's any such thing as honest reporting or real journalism. In their minds, everything is propaganda.
This is taking it a step beyond what we're used to. So in all Western democracies, governments tell stories that paint themselves in a good light and their opponents in a bad one.
What we're talking about is a regime whose undergirding ideology isn't nationalism, isn't communism, isn't fascism, it's cynicism. And that's why they've rejected the very concept of truth, and they believe that they can manipulate the Russian media and the international media through spinning these stories, often many stories at once, in order to undermine them.
All right, let's talk about a very recent event, which is the killing of the opposition politician Boris Nemtsov last Friday. Now, many commentators believe this happened at the very least because President Putin wanted it to happen. How is the story being reported? Is there disinformation being put into the media?
The Kremlin is spinning out various plates into the mass media. There are all kinds of different stories designed to confuse the population or to create doubts about what the reality is. They put out various narratives, and they're all about creating confusion, that he was killed by Islamists, that he was killed by a business partner, that he was killed by a competitive lover, that he was killed by the Ukrainian secret services, that he was killed by nationalists. In fact, that he was killed by everybody, including the CIA, apart from the Kremlin.
I have seen, I think, six or seven different theories, and President Putin has said that this is an attack on the state.
Yes, well, you can believe President Putin the way you believed him when he said there were no Russian troops in Crimea and there were no Russian troops in eastern Ukraine.
You've mentioned Ukraine a couple of times. What is the line that's being run to the Russian people about what is going on there?
The line that's being spun about what's happening in Ukraine is very frightening. It's reminiscent of the propaganda deployed by the Milosevic regime in Serbia, in which the enemies of Russia are presented as Nazis, as fascists, as a junta. This is all about picking up these horrible, gross scars in the Russian psyche from World War II, and they've whipped the population up to think that they are confronting the Nazis, and that's what they're calling them. So I had a very unfortunate experience debate with a Kremlin propagandist on Al Jazeera the other day. He's called Sergei Markov, and I think it was possibly the worst thing ever recorded on Al Jazeera, because the man was simply shouting Nazi, junta, fascist, and repeating these emotive, sloganeering words so that there could be no discussion.
Yes. What about if we turn to audiences outside of Russia? Is the Kremlin waging what you might call an information war against Ukraine?
The Kremlin is trying to spread disinformation massively through the Ukraine crisis, and we see various strands come up. For the international media, they first spread the myth that the Ukrainians are led by Nazis and are anti-Semitic. And the purpose of this was to make Congress turn against Ukraine, was to try and make Israel and the global Jewish community turn against Ukraine, and was to try and make bien-pensant opinion turn against Ukraine. And this is very, very far from the truth, because the reality is that in a Europe that's seen a lot of attacks on Jews in this year, they've not been happening in Ukraine. And compared to Britain or France with the National Front or UKIP or Pegida in Germany, the far right in Ukraine as a proportion of the vote has got a very small amount. That's one of the stories they've been spinning. The big Russian offensive, though, was around the MH17, and we've seen all kinds of myths about this propagated, from it being shot down by the CIA to being shot down by Ukrainians, all about deflecting the blame from Russia's Russian-controlled forces in eastern Ukraine. What they've been trying to do is to grab hold of anti-European sentiment in the right in Europe, or anti-NATO sentiment on the left, with this idea that sort of German-dominated empire or an American-dominated empire, whatever you want to believe, is advancing rapaciously into Russian lands.
Yes, I've seen some extraordinary videos in the last couple of days that are online. They portray Angela Merkel as a kind of towering figure. They say the CIA is behind the shooting down of the aircraft, and America always makes money out of war, and America is behind these attacks on Russia to make money.
Well, there's an undergirding of anti-Semitism to it as well, with the endless use of the term neocon. And I actually have quite left-wing views on what should happen, certainly in British politics, but definitely online I get attacked, I think, 10, 15 times a day by Russian troll bots either calling me a Zionist or calling me a neocon, which I think is quite cowardly, because they should at least be man enough to call me a Jew.
What about the role of Russia today, Ben? This is a big, ambitious, it's well-funded TV network. It now broadcasts in three languages, English, Arabic and Spanish, and it is beamed to audiences outside of Russia. What is its role?
Well, Russia Today was conceived of by the Kremlin as an answer to CNN and as an answer to France 24. And the idea was that Russia Today would disrupt the narratives that these channels were spreading, that Russia Today would broadcast in a way that would undermine them and that would spin disinformation and counter-information, or information that would just make Russia look good into the international media. So it was headed since its foundation by an immensely talented woman called Margarita Simonyan, who is one of the most impressive media executives of the 21st century. And her key insight is that no one would ever watch Russia Today because they wanted to know about Russia. Nobody cares, she's told me, about Russia. What they wanted to find out about was an anti-American view of the world. And she said that she gave more and more time to anyone in the Western world or in the Middle East who didn't feel that they were getting their fair calling on the mainstream media. So that's extensive coverage of the National Front in France, of UKIP in Britain, of conspiracy theorists in the United States, of anti-American forces in the Middle East, so on and so forth.
And actually watching it, you do see some stories that are interesting and different from what Western mainstream media tends to cover.
Well, her key insight was that she just had to be different. She said she sat in this office and there were sort of 16 screens in front of her, and they all had the same white male and white female presenter presenting the same stories in the same order, with the same colours of the TV channel, which were red or blue. And she knew instantly that she had to have presenters that looked different, she had to have different camera angles, and she had to have different stories. And that she was going to basically abandon the news agenda and have a news channel driven basically by what people were interested in. She said that in order to get people watching the channel, it would have to be green, because other channels aren't green. People were never going to sit down and be like, I'm going to watch a bit of Russia Today, so I want to find out what Putin thinks about this. People were going to be channel hopping, they would see the green, they would be drawn in, and she would have lots of things like space travel that people are fascinated by. So Russia Today, she's told me, does lots of computing to see who's watching what, and she does a lot of space coverage. So that's a good way to wheel people in.
Ben, how effective do you think the propaganda aimed at the West is? Because certainly in the Western media, Putin does not get a free run. He's portrayed as a sort of hyper-macho, to the point of a joke, actually, very humorless, not to be trusted. I'm just wondering if this is a success story.
What they have realised under the intensity of what they think is a new Cold War is take battles that you can win. So they don't really bother in improving Putin's image in Europe or improving Putin's image in Australia or the United States. I think they've lost that. What they are now trying to do is feed information to pre-existing Western constituencies to change their minds about Western foreign policy or clashes in Ukraine. So they pick narratives like NATO started this war, it's all about NATO, because that appeals to the far left. They pick stories like the Ukrainians are anti-Semitic, because they think that will appeal to Congress or to British Jews or French Jews. They've picked stories like there is a Blackwater army funded by the CIA operating in Ukraine and it was trained in Iraq. And that's to appeal to the anti-war movement. And they keep on spinning these stories that fit into that pre-existing cultural clashes we've already got. And they like to exploit our cultural clashes. So they've been very successful in managing to spin the anti-war movement, I think, in Western Europe, which was very opposed, and with good reason, I think, to American adventurism in the Middle East under George Bush. And they managed to convince them that the Ukraine conflict is, in fact, a repeat of that, which, of course, it isn't. In fact, it's an act of Russian interventionism and adventurism.
How much of all of this, Ben? Because this is a big project, if you like, a massive project, mostly internally, but also externally, aimed at really just strengthening the position of Vladimir Putin.
I think, sadly, it's almost all about that. And it's a good question that you asked, because, sadly, the entire Russian state and Russian foreign policy, I think, is today run in the interests of a dictator to keep that dictator in power for the rest of his life.
Ben Judah, the author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin, speaking there with Richard Ady. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file.
Category 105, which is PDF 222 journal.
Speed 220, Category 105.
The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
Now, many of you may remember the classic movie Good Morning Vietnam that starred Robin Williams. He plays the legendary real-life Adrian Cronauer that was on Armed Forces Vietnam Network in the 1960s. Now, during the film, Robin Williams, in the opening monologue as Adrian Cronauer, makes reference to a certain woman.
Oh, I'll get you, my pretty! Oh, my God, it's the Wicked Witch of the North, it's Hanoi Hannah!
Well, that was a clip of Robin Williams from the movie Good Morning Vietnam, where he makes reference to Hanoi Hannah. Now, during the history of broadcasting and conflicts, there actually have been these kind of characters that have appeared. One of the most popular is Tokyo Rose. Now, Tokyo Rose actually simply wasn't just one woman, but there was one, of course, that became very well known for it. The Vietnamese also had one, which was, of course, Hanoi Hannah. During the Second World War in Europe, there was Mildred Gillers, and, of course, the Argentinian Rose from the Falklands conflict. But one that actually became legendary is, well, Hanoi Hannah. Trinh Trinh Nho, who was actually the voice of Hanoi Hannah, passed away October 2nd. We managed to find an interview that she gave to C-SPAN in the early 1990s. But before we go to that interview, let's take a listen to one of her broadcasts.
This is our special broadcast to American servicemen in South Vietnam. Here are the main features. Communique of the People's Liberation Armed Forces Command in Central Nam Bo. A routine report on the situation in Saigon, and our talk to American GIs fighting in Way City. Now, for the detailed report. The armed forces and people in Central Nam Bo, which covers 8 provinces west and southwest of Saigon, have won splendid victories in the first 6 days of their offensive and uprising in 6 provincial capitals, 20 district towns and the rural areas.
We're doing this interview in Ho Chi Minh City. That's in South Vietnam, where South Vietnam used to be. Why did you move from Hanoi here, and what year did you do that?
The fact is that my husband was a southerner, see? So after the liberation of Hanoi, of Saigon, I'm sorry, in 75, so my husband returned to the south, so 6 months later, I joined him, and the whole family moved into Saigon.
Do you have children?
Yes, I have two, one son and one daughter.
Are they both here?
My son is in the States.
What's he doing there?
He's a painter.
What kind of a painter?
Well, you are the first American I say that. I don't want to talk much about my son.
But is he an artist? Is that the kind of painter you mean?
Well, he likes to be become a painter.
All right, is it sensitive that he's there?
He went there long before, of his own will. I don't send him. Even I don't want him to go away from the family, but he likes it. So he just left the family and went away.
What's your husband do?
My husband is an engineer, but he has retired now.
And what did he do in the north during the war? Was he in the war?
Yes, he's an engineer in electronics.
Did you have to be an active member of the party in the north to get the job that
you had? No, even now I am not the party member. Even now.
Did you have to believe in what you were reading to the GIs? Did you write it yourself?
Yes, I took part in the translation. I also doing some of the writing, yes. Of course, we must believe in something.
What did you, at that time, remember believing strongly in? What did you want to happen?
Well, really speaking, I don't want there is war between the Vietnamese people and the Americans who are sent here to fight the war. So we think it's not right. So I just want GIs to resist this fighting, that they don't take part in the fighting. Of course, it's difficult for them because they are sent by the government, but our work is to make them believe that the war they are fighting is not just. It's against the Vietnamese people. The Vietnamese people want their country to be free, so they should not be here, the American GI.
What had gotten you interested in being in radio and television in the first place?
You mean from the beginning?
From the very beginning. Why did you choose that as a profession?
Well, it's, you know, in 55, I began to work for the radio because at that time I know some English. So I live in Hanoi. I never take part in anything for the revolution, so to say. So I just think that maybe it's useful. I can do some useful thing if I participate in some work. And as I know English, so I just volunteered to work for the radio. And the radio at that time, those people come from the jungle. So they just began the program, the English program at that time. So I volunteered to work as an announcer. Of course, I just begin my radio work because I just know English. Not much, but gradually with the work, I got the help from foreigners, Australians, who come to help to train me into an announcer.
And they trained you what, in the 50s, late 50s?
On the job.
On the job, Australians.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Have you met any GIs, American GIs, since 1975, and talked about the radio broadcast?
In Saigon, yes.
Do they look you up?
The ex-GI. One of them is called Jeffrey Clifford. He's a helicopter driver during the war. And after the war, when we returned to the States, he's now a photographer. He made an album of Vietnam for the whole country, and he makes some interviews, and he took some photo of me, and he put it in his album, and I got one album from my son, of course.
What hours of the day during the war did you actually broadcast?
Well, we choose the day that we thought would be suitable for the GIs and return from the fighting. So we broadcast at, I think it's mainly at 8 p.m. Saigon time.
How long were your broadcasts?
30-minute program.
What evidence do you have that any GIs listened?
Of course. It's rather hard to get the back feed, but the feedback, I mean. But we know that they are listening. Recently, after the war, I mean, I had a videotape of Good Morning Vietnam.
The movie.
The video. Mm. So I know a little bit about the reaction of the GIs. But because, you know, our program serve for a cause, so we believe in that cause, so we continue to broadcast, and we know that certainly, if not all of the GIs, maybe some of them can listen, and as we have a cause to serve, so we just continue the work.
From what location in Hanoi did you actually broadcast?
It's in Hanoi. We broadcast, I think it's in the downtown of Hanoi. But the broadcasting station is outside. And during the bombings, we have several broadcasting stations from many parts of the country.
Did you lose any family in the war, or did you come close to getting bombed yourself?
No. I am very lucky. No, none of my family was killed during the war.
What was the atmosphere in Hanoi during those years? Can you remember?
Yes, the first time we heard the siren, the hooter, when there was American plane came to make the first bombing over Hanoi, we were a little bit taken by surprise, a little bit afraid, because we were just working, and just we heard the siren hooted. So everyone, because we were upstairs, so we went downstairs. But just for a little while, then it's over. But you see, when there is alert, even 10 times a day, people become a little bit accustomed to it.
Have you ever been to the United States, by the way?
Me?
Yeah.
No.
I
hope someday in the future I can visit the States.
Do you prefer Hanoi or Saigon if you had the first choice to live? What city?
Well, really speaking, when I left Hanoi to live in Saigon in 76, I am a little bit upset because Hanoi is my native town. I have lived there for a very long time. Everything is very familiar with me. And Saigon is more noisy. Of course, the city is up to date, modern, with many villas. But really speaking, at that time, I prefer to live in Hanoi. Now, as my age is a little bit advanced, I think that the climate of the South is more suitable for me, because in the North there is the winter is very cold. But from time to time, I prefer the autumn in the North, because here you only have two seasons. It's a dry season and the rain season, and of course the dry season is very hot. But anyhow, I think now I get a little bit accustomed to the South.
Now time for propagation. Here's Glenn Hauser.
Keith from Space Weather Canada, the 27-day magnetic activity forecast. In the auroral zone, elevated DRX, nanoteslas, October 11th and 12th. More so October 17th and much more so October 25th. IPS in Australia's global HF propagation forecast through October 8th is normal to fair at all latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through October 8th, magnetic conditions quiet, shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable as always. From Met Office UK through October 9th, solar activity remaining low levels with a less than 5% chance of moderate class flares, given current sunspot complexity. Geomagnetic activity levels quiet to unsettled. From FK Yanda in Prague, the geomagnetic field will be mostly quiet on October 7th, 11th, 14th, and 20th. Quiet to unsettled October 8th, 15th, 16th, 19th, and 21st. Quiet on October 9th, 10th, and 13th. Quiet to active October 12th, 17th, 18th, 23rd, and 24th. Active to disturbed October 22nd, 25th, and 26th. From SWPC in Boulder, geomagnetic field unsettled to active October 16th to 18th, with ANK indices peaking at 20 and 5. G2 moderate activity possible October 24th to 26th, with A's and K's of 35 and 6. Lowest A's and K's of 5 and 2, October 6th to 14th, and 19th to 22nd. Solar flux rising from 85 October 6th to 95 on October 15th to 18th, and down to 80 by October 27th. William Hepburn's VHF, UHF, DX maps show extreme tropospheric ducting off Southern California from October 9th and Baja California October 10th and 11th. Also off the southern coast of Peru October 10th and 11th, off the northwest coast of Africa, increasingly from October 8th to 11th. Across the central and eastern Mediterranean October 8th to 11th, off Angola and Mozambique October 10th and 11th. And all week, all around the Arabian Peninsula as far as India.
All right, that's all we have time for this week. 73 and 88 to the ladies.